little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Menton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
Well, we've got a great guest all connected up with us, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. But we like to take the start of the show to tell folks how they can get in touch with us, how they can pop up the previously archived podcast versions of Thinking Clearly.
Yes, you can find Thinking Clearly on Facebook. Just search Thinking Clearly and it should come right up, where you can find promos and show notes as well as links to our podcast when it's available. Speaking of podcasts, we are also podcasting. Open up your favorite podcast app and also search Thinking Clearly. And again, it should come right up, or visit thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. And you can find our entire archive of shows, almost 7 years now.
Well, Julia, why don't you let folks know just a bit about what's coming up for this edition?
I'm really excited about today's show. Our topic, we're going to be taking a deep dive onto the world of magicians and psychics, and in particular, one man's journey to become a skeptical activist who promotes science and critical thinking.
Let's go back a ways. If you were a believer in consulting psychics, say back in the 1990s, and you called the Psychic Friends Network number for advice, your phone call might have been picked up by Mark Edward, our guest on this episode of Thinking Clearly. But these days, Mark identifies himself by three words prominently displayed on his webpage: mentalism, skepticism, and activism, where it states that Mark, quote, travels internationally as a skeptical activist, using his skills as a mentalist to teach and promote critical thinking, end quote. Mark's authored a number of books on mentalism, seance theory, and production, including the book Psychic Blues, published back in 2012. And he's worked both on and off camera on many related productions, including ABC's The Con and the Learning Channel's Exploring the Unknown. Mark Edward, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. Thanks for finding me and giving me an opportunity to speak to your audience.
Thanks for being here. Let's go ahead and start by digging in on those three words that Bob just mentioned: mentalism, skepticism, and activism. Can you kind of fill us in on what those words mean to you? How would you describe them, and why were they important enough for you to kind of identify with them?
I've always been into magic, conjuring magic, in terms of, you know, sleight of hand, illusions, optical illusions, those sort of things, ever since I was a little kid, because my grandfather was a magician. So when I was around 5 years old, when my parents would drop me off to be babysat, my grandfather would pull out his cigar box full of little tricks, little wire puzzles and, you know, card tricks and this and that, and it would keep me busy for hours. So I guess right from the very beginning, when I started to realize that things aren't always as they seem, it was because of my grandfather and his training of me. So I got into magic at a very young age, I would say. I didn't really start performing till I was in my, like, teens, 11, 12, 13. So I did all sorts of different kinds of magic. I started working professionally at the Magic Castle in 1975. And over those years, I became more and more interested in mentalism, which is a branch of magic where you pretend to have paranormal or psychic powers and you play it in character. You don't necessarily give a disclaimer and say, hey, this is all a trick. You do the best job you can to get people to suspend their disbelief. So for me, it was a rope trick. No longer, I still do rope tricks, but it was more about the mind. And I saw how people really jumped into it and really liked it. And, you know, then one thing led to the other. I started performing the seance at the Magic Castle. They have a Houdini seance. So I did a lot of studies on Houdini, who I'd read about since I was a kid. big idol of Houdini's. And, you know, I learned that in the seance room, it's about emotion. It's something you do that brings out emotions in people. And that was fascinating. Can't be a medium without being able to read a palm or read a tarot card. People will ask for that. So I slid into that mess. And then I realized, you know, magic is not getting me where I really want to be. So at the same time, Uri Geller was happening, and I really wanted to find out what he was doing, because it was puzzling a lot of people, including magicians. So then I got involved with the skeptics in around 1979 or 80. The more I got into the skeptics, the more I realized if anything real was out there. And of course, back then I still had high hopes. I figured it's not going to come from the believers. It's going to come from the scientists and the people who test these sort of things, which were the skeptics and the scientists, even though they could be fooled too, believe me. So I started working with the skeptics and doing magic at the same time. And when the Psychic Friends Network came around, I saw these charlatans, you know, on television. I said, hey, I can do that. I have stage training. I can do better. So I joined up with them, and I basically scammed the scammers. I stayed with them, and I learned as much as I could about the business of psychics and how they do what they do, because you can't just go up to a psychic and say, how did you know that? They say, I'm psychic, you know, but really there are a lot of methods to be learned. And so I spent around 9 years going in and out, playing both sides of the game until I had enough to write my book. Then I wrote my book, and now I still do a performance, but at the end, I kind of say, you don't think I really talked to your dead grandmother, do you? You know, I diffuse it by maybe giving away a few secrets of the psychics, but I don't completely disillusion the audience, because again, you never know who's a believer and who's not. So that's why I say I'm a skeptical activist, because now I travel around and I do mostly skeptical performances. I don't do a lot of in-character seances. So that's pretty much the whole run right there.
You mentioned an important name too, if a single icon of skepticism, activism, mentalism, and magic, it would be Houdini. He really kind of started the ball rolling.
Yeah, well, there were other magicians before him who did the same thing, but he was the one who really made it public, and he was a showman. He got it. He got the attention that was needed. Of course, we had James Randi, who was
he's the modern,
you know, a dear friend. He wrote the introduction to my book. He kind of took the torch from Houdini and tried to keep busy revealing the charlatans and what they were doing.
His full name being the amazing Randi. Yes.
The amazing, yes, and he surely was.
Well, that was a great overview, Mark, and we're going to get into all of that much more deeply as the show goes on, and we are going to get a demonstration of mentalism later on, and we're really looking forward to that. Well, Mark, in your book, Psychic Blues, you describe your journey to become a mentalist, skeptic, and activist. So take us on a brief tour of those life experiences.
Mentalism is a fascinating subject to get involved with, because it basically uses techniques of magic, but you don't call it magic. You don't pull a rabbit out of a hat. You don't do the Chinese linking rings. You come out and you try and be as professorial as possible. You discuss very briefly the powers of the mind, and then you go ahead and you do magic effects, although they are disguised by the things that people tend to believe in. That would be ESP, ghosts, telekinetic, making things move with your mind, predicting future events, those sort of things. And you leave the stage with people, hopefully their jaws are dropping on the floor, because they have no idea how you were able to know certain things and you don't tell them. So that has always fascinated me ever since I was in my teens. And I decided that I would investigate as much as I could how this stuff was going on. And that's how it led into being a quote unquote professional psychic. I was fascinated with these people and their methods. And I was lucky enough to rub shoulders with some of the greats and make friends with them, much to their chagrin in most cases. I count Uri Geller as a friend. Whenever I see him, he greets me by saying, "Mark, my favorite skeptic," you know, so he respects me. I respect him. I never challenge him. I respect him as a performer, not a true psychic, because all of us know that Geller is a trickster. But if you've ever seen him perform, he is absolutely amazing to watch how he takes advantage of the moment. He is very gracious. He's very charming. He has all the aspects of the perfect charlatan. So while I do not like psychics because of the emotional damage that they do and the way they extract money from people, their methods and their procedures and the artifices that they use to accomplish those goals, I really do like, because I think that one of my lectures I recently did, it was called "Cold Reading is Now a Survival Kit." Everyone should understand how it works so that you don't get taken advantage of, because we live in an era where lying is now a accepted business practice, and you got to start somewhere. And I think with the psychic business, that's the lowest you could possibly go. It needs to be resolved, or alternatives need to be given out to the public so that they can at least question things before they dive into it. I don't really like the term skeptic, and I just came back from a convention in Las Vegas, PSYCHON, which is the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. And I learned a new phrase, because a lot of times people say, "Oh, you're a debunker." I used to say that to Randy all the time. I don't like that term, because my mind is open. I just need to see the evidence. Anecdotes are not evidence, okay? So I learned a new term, which is called pre-bunk, which means you inoculate the public with the alternative fact, which is, again, another verbal deception, but it works when you can use it. You know, you let people know, no, if somebody could actually see the future, they'd be the most dangerous person on the planet. That's kind of my contention. And what we teach people is to ask, what is more likely? When you see something or you hear something, think it through. Take a second before you emotionally invest yourself. Say, what is more likely, that this person can talk to my dead grandmother, or is he just a really good talker? So that's where I'm at today, and I still love a good magic act. I still will go out of my way to see a good mentalist, because of their skill set is something that, their ability is, if they're good, they have what is called situational awareness. And that's what police do and detectives do, and Sherlock Holmes did. And if you remember the old Sherlock Holmes TV show where he would, you know, the one with Benedict Cumberbatch, they would show his thought processes with little dotted lines, and he would look at something, a cigarette in an ashtray, or he would go over here. So when you get involved with a mentalism, you learn to trust your intuition and walk into a room, and, you know, like police, they're trained, it's called the blue sense. First thing they do when they walk into an environment is look where the exits are. So there's nothing psychic about it. It's just common sense. So common sense has become uncommon sense, and people just don't have it. So what we try and do is get people to think a little bit more about what's more likely. Let's just leave it at that.
We approach the realm of what we talk about in this show, critical thinking. Would it be fair, Mark, to say that the difference between one difference, major difference between a mentalist and a psychic, is that a mentalist is making it clear that he or she is not working in the supernatural realm, whereas a psychic.
Well, I don't know, because I don't like to make it clear, because that destroys some of the mystery, and I get in a lot of problems with skeptics and even people in the psychic entertainment world who are very upset that I don't do a disclaimer. My role as a performer is to entertain, and the main difference between a psychic and a mentalist is a mentalist accepts and lets the audience know that there is a stage that he is on. He's in a theater, he's in a venue, he's on television. That is the disclaimer. Because if you really had these powers, you wouldn't need to sell tickets or go on television. You would have this ability to go and get lotto numbers, go to the racetrack, all these possibilities. So what I tell people is, no, it's a psychic. Their whole thing, the reason why a psychic or a medium does a show is to get their hooks into vulnerable people who are in the audience. Every time I've seen one, they say, if you like what you heard, which is dubious at best, then be sure to talk to my assistant in the back of the room and I will give you a private meeting. So their shows are used as advertisement to get their hooks into the bereaved and the people who are really lonely and who have some money to spend. They're not entertainment. Making somebody break down in tears is not entertainment to me. It really makes me very angry when I see this going on. So the idea with a psychic is they want you to believe. The idea with a mentalist is they don't care whether you believe or not. They're there to entertain you. Okay. And also, if I do a show and I do it in character, all anybody has to do is go to my website, www.themarkedward.com, and you will immediately see in a minute where I stand with both feet on the ground and telling people, look, this is a skill anybody can learn, but beware of where it can lead.
And I'm glad you brought that up about the downside of the practice, because some people might ask the question, don't psychics just help people feel good?
No, they help themselves.
Yeah.
That's a popular fallacy that I think needs to be shattered, because if they really wanted to help people, they'd give them one quick reading, give them the once over, tell them what they need to know, and then say, I don't ever want to see you again. So don't call me because I won't talk to you. I have your name. That's it. But they don't do that. They get their hooks in and they see where the vulnerabilities are. They see where they can dig in. And then they never let go until they've exhausted all that person's money, their home, their marriage, their family. We call them grief vampires, which I think is an apt phrase. We're working on a book right now called Grief Vampires, which is about some of the stings we've done against these people. They're sociopaths, by the way.
So, in talking about some of your experience with the Psychic Friends Network, you said you were there for, a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a few years since I've actually heard about the Psychic Friends Network or seen an advertisement.
They've broken up in all sorts of other units now, so.
Yeah, so maybe you could give us a little refresher on what that was all about, and also, from your perspective, what happened there on the inside.
The quick answer to that is they got too greedy, and they started to use questionable business practices, which I won't go into, but you can find out about it in my book. I saw them on television on one of their infomercials one night, and I said, my goodness, if they can do this, I can do better. Because most of the psychics who were working for them at the time did not have any sort of stage presence or show business background. They did not know how to handle an audience. They mostly believed in themselves, or they were just charlatans. They were just trying to get by. So I said, well, look, I've been doing mentalism for about 15 years now. I am going to go in there and I am going to scam the scammers. I'm going to convince them, using my skills as a mentalist and a stage personality at the time, that I'm the real deal. So I figured if there's anybody who deserves to be played at their own game, it would be this group of individuals. So I did. And I climbed to what I would say would be the top of that slag heap, which was quite a climb. But I got to the top of the mountain and I looked around and I said, okay, I've got enough material now. It's time for me to get away from this and start writing my book. There's a famous quote by Harlan Ellison, a writer. I'll compare it to Hollywood, where he said, being in Hollywood is like climbing to the top of a dung heap to pick a rose. But by the time you get to the top, you can't smell anymore. So it was starting to affect me and my outlook on humanity. So, and I had a conscience. So I said, I got to get away from this. So that's how the book came out. And there's also, by the way, an excellent audio book.
You are the reader in that audio book.
Yeah. See, what happened is when Farrell House, who was my publisher, when they published Psychic Blues, they edited about a third of the original manuscript out because they just wanted the dirt. They wanted a really kind of nasty character. So they took a lot out, and I wasn't really especially happy with that. So what I decided to do is read it myself and add in all the things that I thought were funny, crazy, kooky people I met, what my influences were. So the audiobook is an expanded version of the book. By the time I made that second round of doing audiobooks with it, the first one didn't work. I was so sick of that book that my, I won't call it negativity, but let's just say there's a certain tone in my voice which came across and made the book even better. So, and I added in some music cuts, little bits of sound effects, just to pepper it a little bit. So I'm very happy with it. So, and if you have Audible, you can probably get it for free right now. So
give the title of that book again.
Psychic Blues, Confessions of a Conflicted Medium.
A while back in our discussion, you mentioned that you got involved with the skeptics. A couple of questions. First, tell our listeners and us a little bit about how you got involved, what prompted that. And even go back further, see if you can remember back when you really first felt like you were a skeptic, where that skepticism
came. Okay, I can tell you that story. It's a good one. At one point, I was working at a store in Hollywood called Hollywood Magic Company, which was kind of the, it was the mecca for magicians in Hollywood, and probably the biggest magic store west of the Rockies. So a lot of people came in there and a lot of people bought things. And I had some really good teachers who were just starting to educate me about the difference between magic and mentalism. So one night I'm watching television and I surf to this channel and I see this guy. His name was Elias. And Elias was standing up in front of an audience and he was telling people these things. Again, that he could have no possible way of knowing, which is one of my favorite lines, because, oh, yes, there are ways. But remember, I was still doing card tricks and things like that. So I see this guy and I'm like, wow, how is he doing this? I was probably 22 years old, 23 years old. I was amazed in the looks on the faces of the audience. Now it's common. We see this all the time with mediums who are on talk shows and things like that. But back then, he was a one-off, and I really thought, wow, what if you could do this? What if this guy's for real? So the thought stuck in my head, and I remember what he looked like, and I remembered his name, and then the show went off, and I didn't hear about him. Then one day, I'm working in Hollywood Magic Company, and he comes walking in the magic shop, and I'm like, you're Elias, aren't you? He says, yes, I am. You know, he's all full of himself. And I'm like, aren't you afraid some of your believers are going to see you coming into the magic store? And he said, listen, where's your mentalism stuff? Because, you know, sometimes I just have to be right. Sometimes I need to push the envelope a little bit. So he was basically telling me that he was using mentalism, although I wasn't really aware of how to do these sort of things. But to me, that was a big moment of realization that, oh, you're a trickster. You're not a real psychic. So that's when I kind of turned the corner and said, this is great. I'm gonna find out more about this.
Do you remember ever feeling like you were a skeptic before that one event happened?
I was a skeptic since my grandfather said, you know, my first memory of my grandpa was I don't know if you remember this, maybe you do, it's kind of an old image, but back in the 50s, they used to have this, there would be a magazine page like in Life or Look or whatever, and it would be what was called a Quitman sampler, which was a box of chocolates. Do you remember that, anybody? No. Anyway, it was a full color picture on two pages of a big box of chocolates. So one day in my grandfather's living room, he's opening the magazine and he's looking at me. He says, "Hey, Mark, come here. I want to show you something." And I said, "What?" And I came over and I looked down, and on his lap was this picture of a box of chocolates. And he reached in and he took a chocolate out and he gave it to me. So I was like, that's it. Grandpa's a wizard, you know. But I knew he was doing a trick because he had already taught me a lot of other tricks. Mm-hmm. So, but that was a moment where I said, oh yeah, illusion is everything. So the seeds of skepticism were sown, you see. So I knew it didn't come out of the magazine, but I loved it anyway. That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is the thing, is magic can invoke sort of that wonder that I think is why it's so entertaining.
Yeah, and for me, one of the greatest things about magic is the look on a kid's face the first time he sees magic. Because up to a certain age, they'll believe in anything. You know, they'll believe in fairies and Barney and all that. But at around 7 or 8 or 9, they start to question things. You show them a magic trick and you see their eyes pop open because they know what you did couldn't have happened. That's a very satisfying feeling because you've opened a new door in their mind.
Yeah. So going back to kind of this theme of skepticism and activism, you know, those two kind of topics bring to mind two activist projects that you've been involved with, namely the Guerrilla Skeptics and, the, as you mentioned, the Grief Vampire Investigations. Can you kind of describe those for us and, you know, maybe give us an update where those projects are at now, what they've been up to, what kind of good trouble y'all are making?
Well, we continue to make trouble as best we can. Unfortunately, since COVID hit, the psychic market has really taken off even bigger because whereas before, psychics that we used to work with, I'm not going to mention any names, not work with, but work against, they would sell out these huge arenas with 300 or 400 seats, and then they would go in and they would do their thing. But now since COVID, those arena shows have dried up. However, the smart psychic has now learned about Zoom, and Zoom makes it really easy to do a reading. I won't give you the reason why, but let's just say, you see how my name is on the bottom corner of the screen? I can have 50 people on that screen and pick one out and find out about them. So it's they've got a leg up now. What was your question? I'm not sure I answered it.
Well, just the activist projects you've been involved in, the Guerrilla Skeptics.
The latest one that was the most egregious was a psychic named Thomas John. We did a thing that was in the New York Times about him. The latest thing he did that we went after was he decided he was going to do a Zoom call for children aged 5 to 12 years old. He was going to show them how that they were spiritual beings and that they could talk to the dead as well. And we just, you know, to us, that was the worst form of child abuse you could think of, because the parents were the ones that were pushing the kids. The kids don't know how to get on Zoom. And it was $400 per kid. And so he had 8 spots open. We took 3 of them and we planted 3 of our kids in there, and we stung them pretty bad. In other words, he walked right into it. He took the bait that we gave him, but it doesn't necessarily stop these people. They just like, oh, well, there's a sucker born every minute. I'll just move over here. It's like a moving target. So it gets really frustrating. And part of the reason why it's frustrating is because the media, the greater media, I will add, don't really show any interest in this. So, and we had people from NBC who said, oh, we want to be in on this. We want to follow how you do it and what you're doing. They backed out. And this is with children, you know, children who were crying on the screen because they missed their grandpa or their grandma. And so now we're in a holding pattern. We have the granddaddy of all stings in our pocket, but we have decided we are not going to do this sting until we get big media coverage. That means somebody like 2020 or not Inside Edition. We've already worked with them. We need a good half hour or 20 minute episode. If you watch The Con, that's a good friend of ours who produced that. He also produced Penn and Teller's Bullshit. Never saw any of those. Something like that, where we can not show both sides. We have agreed that we are not going to be involved with anything that shows both sides. It says, well, maybe there are spirits or fairies. So no, we are going for the jugular. We're going to show how ruthless these people are and how low they will go. But no one wants to touch it. So hopefully, you know, this will change. We're right in the middle of this election cycle. And, you know, like I said before, lying has become an accepted business practice. Maybe people are going to start waking up and saying, wait a minute, you know, my sister-in-law lost $180,000 to a psychic medium, which is true. We know when this happens. Maybe we ought to look into it. Police don't care. They're like, well, you know, if it's her money, if that's what she wanted to do with it, we can't stop her. So educating the public and using humor, okay? In other words, you can't preach to them, just like it's like people who are in AA. If you're not ready for it, you're not gonna be ready for it. So we're trying to inoculate and pre-bunk. Think about that, pre-bunk.
I hope this isn't kind of too obvious of a question, but you know, you say you're looking sort of for kind of big mainstream media to share the work that you're doing.
It's called Operation Mima Bee. That's the biggie.
And so your goal, you know, what I'm kind of hearing is, would be just that, to inform the general audience about these things even happening, to inoculate people, to, you know, I guess sort of the question is, what is your desired outcome by doing something like that?
Well, as a performer, my goal has always been to reach the greatest amount of people possible. So my goal is to have people go, what? There's no proof about talking to dead people? What? Stick a little skepticism under the doormat with people so that they at least can say, what is more likely? That would be a great title for the show.
And you want a lot of people to go, what?
Yeah, because I want people to be knocked back on their heels and say, wow, I got taken advantage of by that storefront psychic down the street. She's not real. You know, that's exactly what she did. And we get letters and testimonials from people all the time to tell us, thank you so much for doing this sting, because until I read the write-up on it, which you can read about at a place online called abouttime.com, which is, it's about time. And a lot of our stings are on there. So, you know, they read those and then they write us a letter and say, wow, thank you so much. You saved my life.
These things like you're involved with the Great Vampire Investigations, these stings are a lot of work to set up. I've read a little bit about how much work and how you do that.
Don't kid yourself. Some take a lot of work. Some can be set up in like 10 hours or less. Uh-huh. That's what guerrilla skepticism is about. I kind of coined that term because the idea is, we go in under the radar, we go underground, we don't get up into the face of everybody until we have all the evidence we need, and then we get it published or we put it in a magazine. So don't be put off. Yeah, there's some work involved, but it's fun. It's actually fun to do.
But the point I was going to make is that there is an amount of work and coordination that it takes. And so if I was involved in something like that, I, like you, would want it to get out to the most people that we can. Because in this day and age of things going viral or just laying there and nobody paying attention to them, what makes an impact is when it goes viral, when you have a lot of people that get involved, a lot of people that hear about it, get excited about it, and see the point of it. So really endorse that. We're a show about critical thinking. So give us your take on what it means to you to be a critical thinker and why that's important.
I can make it really simple. When I was a magician, one of the first things I learned, and I taught magic for 12 years, critical thinking is when somebody shows you one hand and they say, look here, look at this, look at this, look at what the other hand's doing. That's critical thinking. And once you develop that ability, it becomes second nature. It becomes part of your life. When I taught magic, one of my magic students, after they had taken the course, they said, you know, you've ruined all magic for me. I said, hey, I'm sorry. You signed up. They said, yeah, now I can't look at the hand that's being waved in front of me. I'm always looking at the other hand. So congratulations. Yes. That's critical thinking. I mean, you don't have to focus on it, but at least you're aware of it and you're thinking in two different directions. You're looking at what the person wants you to look at, but you're also aware of what the other hand's doing. Mm-hmm. That's how I got my start in critical thinking. Is I think when I was a child, my grandpa, since he did such great sleight of hand, I just started looking where I wasn't supposed to look all the time. Like when I was, my parents made me go to church. And when I would go to church when I was a little kid, the pastor would be up there, yadder. But I would be looking at the curtains and the stained glass windows and the woodwork. And, you know, I was not even there. I was not in that holy realm. I was in a realm of my own, which was like, what is all this? What's going on here? So I think learning how to look at the other hand is a really good thing to start with. So when you see a magician next time, don't look where he tells you to look.
Very good. And we could use that whole idea on social media too, when we get fake news and things that don't look right to us, not just pass them on as if we accept them and want to pass them on, but to look at the other hand.
And that goes with skepticism too. You know, when I first got involved, I was like, hey, I am skeptical about being too skeptical, you know, and I try to adhere to that because I always have an open mind. But anecdotes are not evidence. And I've been involved for like 35 years, never seen anything that could even make me wonder whether what I saw was real. I've seen some damn good magic, but, you know, I it's in the proscenium of a magic performance.
And I do want to remind folks that we are talking to Mark Edward. He's a mentalist, skeptical activist, and author of a number of books, including Psychic Blues, Confessions of a Conflicted Medium, which is available both in print and audio formats. So at this point, let's take some time now, Mark, for you to demonstrate what a mentalist does. And then we'll have a discussion about that after the demonstration. So you're going to do a demonstration of that with Julia.
Okay. Yes.
Are you ready?
My mind is as relaxed and blank as it can get.
Well, the first thing, obviously, you're a skeptical person, so I better be pretty accurate. I have this feeling you're an outdoors person. You are very much involved with the environment. The you know, being outdoors is very important to you. You're not somebody who's going to be particularly happy stuck in a windowless room with a computer all day. You need, and also to a certain extent, people are very important, but I think that the environmental thing is really a number one situation. As far as people goes, I think you are an organizer of people. You see people and you kind of can manage them by sensing out where they would fit here together, almost like a labor management or something like that. Something where, yeah, you're involved in management of people. I think that's very important. I get a couple different numbers. I get 6 and I get 8. I'm going to say 3 and 8 go together. 38. You're not 38. Would that be the month you were born and your birth date? You don't that have is, to tell me. Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's exactly when I was, that's my birth date.
So yeah, you're 3 and an 8, but I can't, what is this? Why am I picking up the sixer? What are the sixer? It's not me ringing any bells?
The 6 isn't ringing a bell.
Cat person. I got that right. I think if you have problems, wait a minute. What's the sixer athletes?
The sixer what?
Sixer athletes. Never heard of it?
No, it doesn't ring a bell for me.
It's something, and it's funny because, you know, later tonight I'm going to be in San Jose. So when you went to high school, there was nothing called the Sixer athletes?
No, I didn't go to high school.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, well, this is not an exact science. I am sorry. Wow. I think sometimes if you have issues, it's because you may try and do too many things at once. And when you spread yourself thin like that, it's hard for you to grab a hold of something and really focus on it. You can find success, but you have to put everything else on the back burner and focus on that one thing. And I think that's especially true in your love life. Okay, so I think that your love life is you're very strong in that area, but you have to say what it is you want to be successful, and also you're not easily, I don't want to say satisfied, but you're not, what's the word? Most of the people who you meet in your life do not impress you. And the ones that do, you can go totally overboard for, and then you get into a problem because you put all your faith in something or someone and it turns out to be a sham. That's part of why you're a skeptic. So I think, again, I'm going to go back to finding solace in nature, especially near the coast. So that's where that's your church. That's your church. That's where you get all of your, not all of your, but a lot of your enthusiasm, a lot of your best ideas come through when you can kind of get outside yourself in that sort of environment. Okay. So how many cats do you have?
I have just the one.
Just the one? Because I was picking up 3 cats. Anybody else have 3 cats? Maybe it's me. Anyway. So I do see a bright future for you. I see you as somebody who works best when you don't have somebody breathing down your neck and telling you what to do. So you will have a business of your own if you don't already. And I think you can handle that as long as you use your intuition when making choices about business partners or people to put your faith in. And again, don't go overboard. Listen to your intuition and you're going to be all right. That's it.
What? That's reassuring.
Yes. Well, we want to stop with something reassuring, you know?
Let's have a discussion about this and just reactions. Julia, you want to give some reactions to what that was like?
I would say you definitely were more accurate than not. You picked up on some key things. I think nailing my birthday early on is definitely a way to like win some trust, like, because that's a very specific, you know, kind of thing that I also felt that you teased around it just enough, you know, that you were kind of like searching for it. It wasn't like something that you had seemingly prepared. You also got my job pretty much spot on. Fact that I'm a cat, the fact that I live in the woods. However, I would say I'm pretty happy in a windowless room with a computer.
Yeah.
But
not forever though.
For a pretty long time.
Yeah, okay.
I basically live in a windowed room with a computer in the outdoors. So
that'll make a difference.
I am a cat person. So like I said, you're definitely more accurate than not. Of course, being a skeptic, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking I could find all that on the internet probably in 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay, tell us the difference between a cold reading and a hot reading. Tell us the difference.
In front of you. Here's the difference between a cold reading and a hot reading.
Okay,
well, little bit of preparation.
Yeah.
For the
as soon as you guys started fooling around with the sound and everything, I went into Susan and I gave her. Remember, I asked you for your name. She went in there and went on Facebook and got all this information for me.
Okay, and Susan is your partner in crime and in skepticism.
It's not a crime. It is not a crime.
No. I mean,
this is the information age. This is why I tell people.
Okay.
We put our most intimate stuff up on the computer. It's your own fault if you get fooled by it.
So that's the difference between a hot reading and a cold reading, right? A cold reading, you don't do any preparation, and a hot reading, you do some kind of preparation, check the internet or other ways, find out information about
the person. You know, the professional medium will check Facebook, Instagram, obituary files, whatever they need to do to find out. If I had a little more time, I could have found out your grandfather's name.
You make a good point too, and I just kind of want to emphasize that is most people don't realize just how much personal information is on the internet, and that sort of
stuff is
used not just by predatory psychics, but also catfishers and all kinds of other people who are looking to take advantage. So I just want to, as sort of a techie, I just kind of want to throw that out there to folks that you know, if people are bringing up a lot of personal information, you may want to consider for a minute how much you are putting out there about yourself.
Yeah. We just, a good friend of ours, a dear friend, just wrote an article in the Skeptical Inquirer. She's just been a skeptic like 30 years, and she got taken in by a romance scam. Very carefully worked out, and man, she broke her heart.
For Bob's edification, a catfisher is, and for our listening audience, a catfisher is somebody who pretends to be somebody other than who they are and generally tries to make romantic relationships with people online, generally for the purpose of exploiting them for money and whatnot.
Okay. Yeah.
I do want to fill our listeners in a little bit. Mark mentions Susan. Susan is your partner.
Yes.
In many ways. And Susan is Susan Gerbic, who was our Thinking Clearly guest back in June 2019, Thinking Clearly episode number 36. And listen to Susan Gerbic explain her work with guerrilla skeptics.
So, Julia, do you feel let down that I showed you that I went on the internet while you were?
No, not at all. I mean, it's what I expected. You know, it's
okay, good.
What I would do if I were asked to do something like this. And I do want to say that your approach was really interesting because it's almost like if you were too specific and 100% accurate, it would be less believable.
That's right. That's why we use psychics, use it. Mentalists use it. It's one of the big secrets, which is called, it's called the too perfect theory. And that is that if it's too perfect, it's got to be a trick. But if you're wrong a little bit and you're a little unsure and you make a few mistakes, it makes it more believable because you appear to be more human maybe a little bit vulnerable. You're not some sort of magical personality. You're just somebody who's picking up the vibes. And I learned that, and I use it all the time. If I get your birthday, March 8th, I'm not going to just say you were born on March 8th. You know, there's no drama in that. I've learned that when you're getting paid for an hour show, take your time, because people want to see that process. So yeah, that's a big, big, major secret, the too perfect theory. And believe me, watch any of these mediums work, and they're wrong more than they're right, which begs the question, why are they asking questions? You know, every time I see one of these people and they're asking questions one after the other, who's this, who's that, what's this, what's that? They're supposed to know. You know, it's like, wait a minute. You're supposed to know these things. You're supposed to make bold statements as facts. And very few of them do.
You had me kind of fishing around trying to think like what the six and the high school.
I still don't understand that because she wrote down Humboldt maybe went to high school Independence High in San Jose. No.
Never lived in San Jose, never went to high school. But the way you asked it, though, had me fishing around in my own memory as to, like, what is it that you could be referring to that I'm not remembering?
And so you want to make the connection.
Mm-hmm.
And for when you're on stage or when you're on screen like this, one of the great moments is when you get some hot read information and you give it to the person, and then you see them realize that they forgot. They say, oh, yeah, I was in a group called the Sixers when I was in high school. So it's like something you even forgot I was able to get. And that just blows the audience away.
Right.
Whoa.
The person that you're reading connects the dots in a very friendly way to what you're doing. In a podcast, I heard you say, Mark, that people in this country are angry about all the lies that they're being told. And talking about activism, which you've told us about your activism, I've had this fantasy of a group of people who are fed up and motivated and well-trained activists creating a movement in critical thinking called information activism. What do you think about that possibility and what might actually have to happen to get that off the ground?
I am not an organizer of groups. I mean, the skeptical movement, we just came back from, like I say, Las Vegas, and there were 600 people there. And the information was considerable. And Neil deGrasse Tyson was the keynote speaker, and what's his name, Richard Dawkins was there. You know, it's a huge mix of people of all sorts of skeptical points of view. I'm afraid the information is a little vague. I think we have to have guerrilla skepticism. We have to be more militant. When you said you were thinking about getting a group going, I was thinking, oh, you mean like a militia? No, not that militant. But the point is, people have to get out on the streets and do something. You know, being online is preaching to the choir. We got to break out of this box that we're in, and we've got to reach through to the people who are really angry, and they're the ones that are tearing this country apart. You know, if they could just understand that they're being lied to, and there is no flat earth, and there is no this or that or the other thing, it would take care of itself. So I can't really help you organize, but I wish you luck. You know, it's been really hard because of COVID for the skeptic movement, and it's a lot of different factions have broken off. A lot of the groups that used to meet disappeared. So we're having a hard time. Well, not a hard time, but people are happy to get back together again. But I don't know about online stuff. I'm an in the street, in your face person as much as possible. And even though I'm on this show, here I am talking, talk. You know, I mean, it's like we're preaching to the choir. Let's get the media involved. Let's, you know, set them straight and find the right people who are willing to break through And now is the perfect time because look at the way the world is moving.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking exactly, is political polarization and what's happening in this country may be a catalyst for that kind of yes. activism to take place.
It well, is a catalyst. It is a catalyst.
Yeah, yeah. From this point on, what do you see as your involvement in promoting science literacy, skepticism, and critical thinking?
We get calls just about every week from different production companies, documentary filmmakers. We're waiting for the right person to dig in and say, okay, we want to do this, because we know they're out there. It's just they don't have the balls to make a move in that direction, excuse the expression. They want to soft pedal skepticism. They want to be in control of it and say, well, we don't know everything. Because they know about ratings, and they don't think that a show, a TV show or a film that really cuts the jugular is going to be popular. But I think it would be. It just has to be done with humor. I think humor is really important. Penn and Teller did a pretty good job with it. There are shows like Brian Conover, Adam Ruins Everything. I did one of those on Ouija boards. There have been certain shows that were able to approach subjects with humor and make their point. And so I don't think it's impossible. It's just, it's going to take somebody who's willing to take a chance. And if they lose out and the show gets canceled, so be it. But it needs to be something that's on every week. It's progressively, you know, you go from week to week. It's a cliffhanger. You're after somebody, you expose them, you go after the next person. It's a continuum that is begging to be shown. It really is, because there is so much humor out there with the things that we see that we sting. How low can you go, you know? How low can you go with your, you know, this guy Thomas John, he had this thing where he was called the seatbelt psychic. You ever hear of that?
Julie is nodding her head, yes.
Yeah, I mean, he went around like pretending he was an Uber driver and people would get in the car and he'd give them a psychic reading.
Your parting comments there were spoken like a true activist. So, Mark Edwards, I want to thank you so much for sharing your journey.
What were my parting comments? I'm not sure.
You're the true activist, getting out there and getting in the streets, getting in the face, you know, that's a true activist statement of what needs to be done rather than talking heads. So we want to thank you so much for your journey, your experience, your convictions. So I'm thinking clearly here. And on our Facebook page, we're going to post a link to your website at themarkedward.com, all one word, themarkedward.com, and to your books. And are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
I'd like you to post Susan's link, which is abouttime.com.
Okay, great.
Which will give people a lot of videos to look at.
All right. And a big shout out to our listeners. Thanks for listening. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.